Today on Medical Matters, the horror of vitamin FF deficiency.
I'm not feeling right.
Vitamin FF is a little known but essential substance for human body chemistry.
My stool is hard.
Lack of vitamin FF can manifest itself in a variety of symptoms.
You know, my head aches and I'm breaking out in cold sweats and my ears are sad and...
Vitamin FF is only found at specifically enlightened radio stations that are committed to the propagation of the freeform style of broadcasting. Check your local listings for a government-approved source.
I haven't been sleeping very well lately either.
WCBN FM, Ann Arbor. Use only as prescribed.
Afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Raymond McDaniel is here in the studio. Ray, thanks so much for coming down.
Thanks so much for having me. I am delighted to be here. I love being on the radio. It didn't moisturize. It's a great day.
And it's sunny outside, right? Little spring in your spring step.
It doesn't matter what it's like outside. We're in the basement now.
It's true. It's true. It's our little world.
There's nothing.
And everybody
outside.
And all the listeners out there.
There's just this.
It's our world, people. Let's get going. So the occasion is the publication of The Cataracts, your latest collection of poetry.
Yeah.
Coffee House Press. An excellent. You've had all your books.
Yes. Yes, this is number four. So I've been with Coffee House, the National Poetry Series, which I was lucky enough to win. They have five winners a year, and the winners are usually distributed between university presses. They're distributed between university presses or independent presses or sometimes big trade presses. And Coffee House was the press who had the judge who selected that first manuscript. And they've stuck with me ever since.
That is something, that's actually a beautiful thing. It doesn't really happen that much in the publishing world, does it?
It doesn't happen much.
Especially for poets.
Yeah, I don't think they're doing it because I'm making them any money.
So they're doing it for your poems.
It's just loyalty. Yeah, I've been really lucky. They've been fantastic.
Okay, before we go any further, I'm going to read your bio. Created by Ray McDaniel in the back of this book. And then we're going to add to it. Raymond McDaniel is the author of Special Powers and Abilities, Saltwater Empire, and Murder, a Violet, a National Poetry Series selection. Some bio there.
Yep.
I love it.
Short, to the point.
And I like also how you don't include the present book because that's self-evident. So you could cut that out, right? Like,
yeah, Raymond McDaniel, who wrote the book you're reading. Yeah, we could have done that. Maybe if there's a fifth book, I'll keep that in mind.
Well, and there's going to be, right? There's always poems that are percolating in your world, but you're also working on a nonfiction project right now about namelessness.
So it's changing shape as it goes. It was originally just about specific namelessness or elective namelessness, but it's kind of changing shape and becoming more about renunciation. right, about namelessness as symbolic of that gesture or impulse to renounce what you've inherited or to turn your back on your civilization or your community, what that means, who does it, that kind of stuff.
That kind of stuff sounds like edge of the seat kind of stuff. So I'll be looking forward to that conversation with you. But let's talk about The Cataracts, a book that has been in the making for a few years.
Yeah, this right? is, I'd been on a 4-year publication schedule prior to this. Book comes out 4 years later, another one comes out. And this one was a 6-year gap. Right. So this was one. So when the last one came out, when Special Powers and Abilities came out, by the time it was published, I wasn't working on anything else. I didn't have anything. So it actually took me a while longer than it's ever taken previously to figure out if there was anything else I wanted to do.
Well, I remember that book release at the Vault of Midnight.
Yeah. And bless their heart. It was awfully sweet.
And then for The Cataracts, it was at Literati Bookstore. Yes. Earlier this spring. Amazing. Yeah. Wonderful evening. These poems, it actually feels like they've been in the works for a while to me, though. I mean, more than 6 years. I know you're like, T, why are you hammering away at this time factor? But I mean, I almost feel like they're older than that. Are any of them from even, I don't know, before that? Like poems that you've had in the Ray Vault?
No. Yeah. So, you know, there were parts of the second book that were written before the first book, and there were parts of the third book that I was working on before the second one came out. But this one was ex nihilo, right? I had nothing after that third book.
And so there was like this nothingness. And how did these poems start kind of emerging from that?
I don't know. I mean, I like to do a new dumb thing every time, right? Sometimes it takes a while to figure out what the dumbest thing to do could possibly be. And for me, with three books with not a lot of consistency between them or a lot of explicitly biographical material, a lot of stuff that focused a lot on how things sounded, right, that were maybe more elliptical or suggestive, I wanted to just be very direct. Right, very direct, very plain. I'm just going to tell you what happened, and I'm going to maybe, in some instances, write in a way that sounds more like the way I talk or think.
So what was that like with your... Did that feel then, because it was something different, I won't say dumb, but did that feel like a risk then for you to be having that, your voice, so more directly on the page?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it felt like a risk because I didn't have any confidence I knew how to make anything interesting out of that kind of writing because I just didn't have a lot of experience with it. And it was also a risk because for me, so much of it is so directly biographical and emotional. Right? So there was just the risk of
that.
Putting yourself out there. Yeah. A lot of people lead with that, right? That's what they tend to go with for their first or their second books. And I just didn't. So I never actually had, I hadn't had that experience yet of just presenting an unalloyed version of myself.
So in this book, we have reoccurring images and words like ocean and sea.
It's just a landscape. I mean, it's just where I grew up.
Florida. So point of origin.
Yeah.
Florida. And so this book is inhabiting that world and the world of mind and memory.
Yeah. It wanders pretty variously, I think, but it definitely has a time and place of origin. Yeah, that's right.
Would that time be 1981?
It's,
or in
it's
what a... way? Let's just talk about 1981. Tell me a little bit about Ray's 1981.
So 1981 was a difficult year for my family. My father, like 80 and 81, he was sick for almost an entire year, in and out of the hospital for various reasons and procedures. And so it was that was very destabilizing. It was very financially destabilizing. And it kind of put us in a weird sort of limbo. So that year stretched in a strange way. Right? Yeah, like a whole imaginative lifetime in a year, maybe. And so not everything that happens in the book, not all the events are actually in 1981, but some core ones, like some key plot points, are definitely that, you know, kind of 80-81 spread. And it's also, and the whole thing has kind of a bleak outlook, maybe. So when I was writing it, there were some echoes between the present and the way things felt in 1981, politically, globally, right? You know, so Reagan has just been elected president. It seemed like the stupidest thing we could possibly have done, right? Just this ridiculous cartoon of a choice. And we have demonstrated that we can make even worse, more cartoonish choices.
Which is actually a line in one of your poems, too. Like, things can get worse. Like, you think things are bad and things can and will be worse.
Yeah. They can get worse before they can get better, and there's no guarantee that they will, in fact, get better.
Is there a poem that you could read now? I mean, what would you like to read that would sort of come into maybe one of the shorter ones that would this be a good time? You know, Cataracts is too long. I don't usually make requests here. Is there one that you think would be evocative of what we've been talking about, Ray?
That's a good question.
Let's see. Is Destiny a Mystique?
A little more personal.
That's what we're talking about, Ray.
That's not. It doesn't point to the political quite so much.
No, maybe. We'll get to that. Want to read Destiny and Mystique?
Sure.
If you don't mind. Okay.
Where did I tuck that thing away?
Oh, 24.
24. Thank you.
Okay.
And we're censored, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, geez. Yes. Yeah.
So you're going to hear a reference to the ice cream additive known as fudge. Destiny and Mystique. The question I would not answer. Are you a boy or a girl? Are you a boy or a girl? And my interrogator would hit me in the face, alternating fists with each cycle of questioning, and might have done so even had I answered, but I didn't like the question, and so fudge him. Or at least that's what I said to myself as I crushed ice and put it in a bag to place over the periorbital hematoma of my left eye. Because even though he had been switching hands, apparently he could only aim with one. Are you a lefty or a righty? A lefty or a righty, I sang, as I read one-eyed about how the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants planned on getting this party, by which I and they meant a better and more just world, started. By killing some pompous senator. And whether it would or wouldn't happen all came down to the actions of an elderly, blind, precognitive mutant whose lover and best friend was a queer, blue, shape-shifting terrorist. It was 1981. And all this for 50 cents. Destiny wore a gold mask and could see the future. And as my eyes swelled shut, I wondered what the future would look like when you couldn't see. And I wondered about Mystique and what it meant to never have to change shape for the person you loved, because the person you loved couldn't see you anyway and didn't care. So when my mother asked me what happened, I said, "Well, Kitty Pryde has come back from the future to change the past." And she said, "No, what happened to your eye?" And I said, "Well, the Brotherhood is fighting for mutant liberation." And she said, "Okay, are they good guys or bad guys? Are they good or are they bad? Are they guys or are they good? Are they bad or are they brothers? Are they X-Men or are they bad guys?" And I said, "They are mutants. They are all X-Men to me."
Thank you, Ray.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'll always stand up for my dorky X-Men poems.
And the sort of the boy culture, young boy culture, the violence of it, present in the poem as well.
Yeah, there was, you know, it's 1981 in the Deep South. There's a concept of bullying, and you don't want to be a bully, but there's no anti-bullying culture, The culture is social Darwinist playground, right? So it was, you just had to tough it out to figure out some way to make it through.
We're going to take a short break and then we'll be back. Today on the program, Raymond McDaniel is here. His book, The Cataracts. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Stephanie behind the glass. We'll be back. Welcome back. You're welcome for that dance interlude. Today on Living Writers, Raymond McDaniel is here. Ray, thanks for picking the music for today's program.
Thanks for asking me to pick. 81 was a very rich year. It was hard to decide what to go with.
So how did you pick that one?
Because if life presents you an opportunity to choose Chaka Khan, you choose Chaka Khan. And 81, Chaka was all over the place. It was both a Chaka Khan year and a Chaka Khan and Rufus year. And people normally don't imagine that could happen, that you could have both at the same time. But 81, we totally did.
Thanks for bringing it with you today, Ray.
I carry her with me everywhere. In my heart.
In the heart.
As all reasonable people do.
Okay, so Florida, 1981, the ocean. There's one of the poems is about, a lot of family is in this book. And even looking back, like, to your mother and her sisters and walking along a seawall and, and there's all these intersections also with this idea of, well, there's lots of playing with words and exploring what words are and turning them slightly. I think the poem that I'm starting to talk about now is Blind Man's Bluff.
Yes.
And within the poem, you also, talk about how the word has changed or had parts of it rubbed off. So
yeah.
The origin was buff. and your mom telling this family story about being pushed off a seawall and not, I don't know. What I would like to do is hear you talk about this poem because there's so much going on with seeing, not seeing, that drop, being pushed or just walking off because you can't see. Yeah. Everything that's built into this story, this lyrical narrative.
Well, it was a pretty famous story in the family. So my mother is one of eight, and all but two of her siblings had kids. So it was an army, right? So lots of aunts, lots of uncles, lots of cousins. And there were certain stories about how those, the aunts and uncles grew up that just became legendary over time. And this was one of them because it's a good story, and they would always laugh about it. But it was also set in and around a place that we were all familiar with. Right. So, you know, it's not even the general landscape. Like, we knew the neighborhood. We knew exactly, like, you know, what cross streets. Right. It's all, yeah, it's just, it was just home. It was just familiar to all of us. But there were a couple of other things about it that resonated, because it's the kind of thing that could happen if you didn't see particularly well. And her vision isn't great. My dad's vision wasn't great. And then, of course, it was compromised by cataracts, which is part of where the title comes from. And my vision wasn't great. So I had an anxiety as a kid about heights because I couldn't gauge distance. And then the whole story snapped into focus for me as a kid when I fell off of the roof of the house that my mother and her sister grew up in, because I spent a lot of time in that house where, you know, their mother still lived before she passed. So yeah, it just kind of all came together in memories, if all those things were related, when in fact they were only associated after the fact, I guess.
Which is how many of these poems are working in the cataracts.
I hope so.
Right? This, do you want to read that one since
yeah,
we've
sure.
talked about it?
Sure. So apologies to my Aunt Nancy, who will not be listening to this. if you feel like you're misrepresented here, Nancy, then I look forward to your next book of poetry.
We take callers. We take...
Blind Man's Bluff. The legend among the sisters goes like this. That the younger one did not mean to walk the elder off the seawall, but did. That it was an accident, but it would have been an odd sort of accident, since the younger child had her eyes wide open and the older child, my mother, had hers closed tight. Nothing my mother did could have been an accident, because she only did what she was told to do, and nothing her sister did could have been an accident, since she was doing the telling. Bear in mind, this was my mother's telling to make us laugh and distract us as we too walked or were walked into air. You know the game. You've likely played it. It is a killer of time and cheap. You know what exculpatory lies you would tell. I told her to stop. I didn't know she was so close to the edge. Tears and protests. But either she was paying attention and it was malice, or she was not paying attention and it was depraved indifference. When my mother walked off the edge of the wall, it might as well have been the edge of the world. Even though at the beach you are always aware of the edge, because you can always hear it. The sea, the stupid wall, exists to stop. Still, hearing it would not stop your body from falling, or help you know whether you were falling a few feet or 10 feet, or from the surface of the earth itself. When I asked her if it hurt, she always said the fear was worse than the pain. I laughed it off by saying, I just had the breath knocked out of me. You don't know that it's about to happen, or that such a thing can happen at all. To be breathless is terror. You are trying to do something you have never had to try to do, and you cannot do it. And everything you want to do, scream, cry, call for help, you cannot. When we asked to be told this story over and over again, my father would attempt to empathize by reminding us that when he was a child, he built a pair of artificial wings and leapt from the roof of his house, and so he, too, had the breath knocked out of him. And my mother would make a sound that was laughing and crying and neither and both and say, "You jumped, but I was pushed." I remember that sound. The expression of too many things at once. What pressure ejects from the vessel lest the vessel explode. It was a story we told because it was funny, and it was good to laugh because laughter kept the vessel from exploding. But then her sister would say, "I didn't push you, you walked off the wall by yourself." No one wants to hear of one's suffering that you did it to yourself. Even when it's true, it's a lie. When you call a blind man's bluff, it could be that you are speaking of the trick or the cliff. The bluff I bluffed you off of. But the name of the game is Blind Man's Buff, and buff means to push. A phrase deteriorated over time, each retelling changing the meaning of the game without changing its rules. That undifferentiated exhalation is what saves the lungs from explosion, an expression that is one thing and the other, which she could not for long moments say because of what she did not see. Falling, whether she jumped or was pushed, saving herself by being breathless. Because then it did not, would not matter, whether she had wanted to laugh or to cry.
Thanks, Ray. And I hope you didn't mind, Aunt Nancy.
Well, I remember one moment very vividly when we were telling this story and we were laughing about it, and Nancy was laughing about it too. And then in the way of the sisters of this family, she was laughing and then she was crying and then she was crying and laughing. And she just committed more fully to crying than laughing and said, "Okay, it's true. I actually did it on purpose. I'm so sorry. I've been lying about it for our entire lives."
What did your mother do?
We were all laughing and we were amazed and Mom was laughing.
Her whole worldview must have been vindicated,
but we had to pull focus really quickly because Nancy just wouldn't stop crying about it. Because she'd been carrying the weight of "I'm innocent" since they were little girls.
Which is a heaviness. For sure.
Apparently so, yeah.
So listening to you, reading the poem, Ray, I also was hearing like the idea of the lungs and the explosion and this release. And that also reminds me how these poems are talking across poems to each other, and how part of one part of the lyrical narrative is the father, and how the father goes in for what he believes to be a cataract surgery, and it becomes
something
about
else.
His lungs, and about not having the breath and
And that word too, you know, has a double meaning.
Cataract.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you? So how did you know this was going to be the title of the book? And when, because in the poem, the double meaning is apparent.
Right.
But I'm wondering, when did that happen for you when you were discovering it or so?
Well, when I was working on some of the poems originally, a lot of it was about the history of optics, right? I did a ton of research. So it's all about vision theory and different ideas of how people have imagined how sight works, different representations of blindness historically and that kind of thing.
Even in film, like Audrey Hepburn.
Yeah, even in film, Wait Until Dark. So that was a lot of the original research work. But because I had a biographical relationship to some of that material, I ended up writing about the setting. And there was no way to write about the setting without writing about all that water, right? Writing about, you know, growing up in and next to and around the ocean and the St. John's and, you know, floods and storms and all that kind of stuff. And eventually it just seemed irresistible, right, that a word that refers to the optical condition, which is also a word less commonly used to refer to rushing water, right? I was like, well, you know, that's as neat as I'm going to, you know, as I'm going to come up with. So let's just go with that.
Right. So it almost felt as if it was meant to be in some way in this, the world of this book.
Yeah, well, once I zeroed in on it, it seemed like that was the obvious choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, the thing, you
but
know,
obvious,
the
but
disease
strange.
That was so pivotal for us historically, right, that made such, you know, that represented such a big deal for the family. But then also the thing that is referential to the physical, geographical context.
Yeah. And perhaps also that feeling, like that explosion of either laughter or crying or pain, this rushing forward.
Yeah, well, and there's also, if the poems talk to each other usefully, you know, there's also the implication there that becomes apparent later that, you know, like I knew in 80 and 81, I was like 10 and 11. So I knew how difficult it was for everyone. And I of course knew, how difficult it was for my mother, but I can't have known how difficult it was for her because I was a kid. Right? I respected the reality that it was difficult. But now I look back and I think, oh my God, right? How did she manage that? Right? Just on a daily basis. And now I can see that one of the ways she managed that is that when she was emotional, when there was any loss of control, right, that very narrow band of expression had to communicate everything, right? So if she was going to be, if she was really going to, you know, burst out laughing, of course she was also going to be crying and screaming because she was just under so much pressure.
We're talking today about The Cataracts, Raymond McDaniel's latest collection of poems out with Coffee House Press. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. And if you're just tuning in, I'm glad you did. Raymond McDaniel is here. His book, The Cataracts, out now with Coffee House Press. As mentioned earlier, Ray has chosen the songs for today's program. UB40.
UB40. Well, you people who thought UB40 rolled up in 1988 with its cover of Red, Red Wine.
Right.
It's been an entire decade, you ding dong. So mistaken.
So we've been talking about how these poems have been talking to each other, and these intersecting narratives, imagery. So even the songs are now playing into this game or so. Or playfulness.
Yeah.
Because so much of what this book is doing is so serious, but there's also a serious play, and the mind of the writer is evident on the page, and so there is always going to be that element of play, yet also
that's what
incision.
I want to go for bleak but also fun. Yeah, so, that you're gonna enjoy yourself on the way down. That's the brand.
So this UB40 song that we just got to hear, it's connecting quite closely with a particular poem.
Yeah, that was 1 in 10 by UB40. And this poem is Decimation. But it was really a lot of time in either a library or an ocean. Sometimes I would walk out of the library and into the ocean. They were that close. What they had in common. More books than people. More waves than people. Neither empty, but populated thickly by things that weren't people. And both free to the public. In a library, I learned the origin of the verb decimate. To remove 1/10 of any given number. Usually soldiers set to be punished for a group offense to preserve the republic. 1/10 of the ocean is nothing to the ocean, though it is also the size of an ocean. A tenth taken away doesn't seem so many, though it must to the taken and those from whom they are taken. Those who remain are also punished, to remember whatever sin consigned the others to oblivion, and the obliterated, a tenth, its remnant. People were so rare in the library, and, if you walked far enough down the shore, so rare on the beach, so few relative to the ocean, infinitely divisible. All the world felt like a remnant of a previous world. Knowing that I was the youngest meant knowing I would become the remnant of a previous world. Now there are too many. Though that is a problem with no just solution, it is also like a wave flattened under the weight of a wave, or a book that falls to dust when you open it, a sin that will punish itself.
Decimation. And so here is another, we've been talking about playing with language, but the serious play, like how you take this word, you even take us to the origin story of learning the word in this very real place, a library by the sea. I feel like this is one of the ways that you reveal yourself as a poet and a thinker. This love of words and what you can do with them.
Yeah. That they very rarely mean what you think they mean. That what they mean and how you use them are not the same thing. They interfere with each other. They enable and enact each other, but there's always a more complicated history of the use of even the simplest word.
And is that something that you find on the page when you're writing, or is it something that you find as you're walking and thinking?
It's one thing leads to another, right? It's the way that you pull something inside out. You're looking at something because you think you know what you're looking at, but in looking at it, it becomes apparent to you that it might not be. Right?
So disconcerting.
So there's an element of illusion or deception that is involved in seeing or thinking at all. Right. So you can't escape it, but you also can't commit to it fully because it's always tricking you. I think maybe that that kind of recursion, right? There's a bunch of Escher prints that are referenced in the book, because that was a big deal for my dad, who was a draftsman and an illustrator, right? That was very resonant to me as a kid, because he would try to teach me how to understand space, because I couldn't see very well, by trying to explain optics by using optical illusions. There's something about optical illusions themselves that I think they're very illuminating in terms of helping us identify what the relationship is between the mechanics of sight and what actually goes on in your brain, right? when you have the experience of seeing something. And I think this is a useful metaphor for what thinking and language is like as well. And there are, there are language illusions in the same way that there are optical illusions.
Right. And the thinking that you know the meaning, and yet having there be, even the saying of something, layers of meaning behind it.
Yeah, even the simplest things, right? So in English, if you say, I am sad, it seems like the plainest expression you could possibly make of your feelings. But if you step back and look at it structurally, what you're claiming is impossible, right? You are saying that, your identity, what you are, is actually fully equivalent to this abstraction. You aren't saying, I feel sadness. In other languages, you might have to say the equivalent of, I have a sadness.
Yes.
Or there's a sadness on me. right? But we walk around, you know, speaking English all the time, saying things like, I am angry, I am sad. And it's highly communicative, and everyone knows what it means, but it can't possibly mean the thing everyone thinks that it does. So, yeah, so that's what I mean by a language illusion.
And is this connecting somehow to the idea of the namelessness project as well?
Well, I mean, there's some trickiness in some of those examples of namelessness, right? Like Odysseus, for instance. When Polyphemus wants to know the name of the person who has blinded him, and I came across that story because I was doing all of, you know, that I was trying to cull all my memories for anything I'd ever read or heard about blindness. And of course, in giving that name and saying no one, right, Odysseus is simply covering the trace of his own presence. Right? You know, not just perpetuating a crime upon this being, but actually making it impossible that anyone would ever believe the crime occurred the way it did.
So as we're talking, the word tricky has come up a couple of times, which is reminding me that there's a poem titled Tricky in here.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, there is.
But I can't remember.
A tiny little thing.
Yeah. Where?
It's near the end. It's 114.
What do you say?
Sure. Short, but yeah, not sweet. Short. Tricky. Our paper arts allow us to render on the square the mountain. Of lamina make the valley and the sink. Night and day, black on one side, white the other. That it is flexible enough to take a crease. Stiff enough to keep one. Bent into butterflies for brides. Folded into cranes to teach flight. Yeah, so that's an origami poem, but it's also about what, how you can create three dimensions on two.
Which is magic.
It is, yeah.
And like a superpower.
Yeah, I mean, that's why kids draw, right? Because they draw because it's an amazing, cognitively shocking thing to be able to do.
Did you used to draw a lot as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
What would you draw?
I drew... This is a very goofy thing to admit, but do you know what a firing solution is? So in ballistics, right, let's say you're on a battleship or something like that, it tends to be a very confusing optical illusion because people think a battleship is, you know, firing off artillery shells, and you would expect them to go in a straight line. But sometimes when you see footage of combat, you think, well, wait a minute, you know, that projectile is being shot out of, you know, of something. Why does it look like it's an undulating array of fire? Right? And of course, the firing solution refers to the calculations that you have to do in order to make sure that that the shells get where they're supposed to go without, you know, getting in the way of some other objective. But that relationship, right, between the mathematical understanding that you have to have in order to perform the act and the fact that you simultaneously believe that it's a bunch of straight lines, but when you see it, it doesn't look like that, right? Because obviously there is, you know, because there are parabolas, there, yeah, things rise, they fall. You know, the object that is ejecting the matter is moving, right? As is the object being ejected. So, yeah, very tiny things like that that you don't even think of. They're not tricks, but you just don't think of them as proof about what you're assuming when you look at something until you see it and think, huh, that looks weird. Why does that look weird?
That scene again, too, and thinking you're seeing one thing.
Yeah, but maybe you're not.
Maybe you're not. Those tricky parabolas.
Yeah, and it's just true for so many things. Stories that you assume that you, you know, that are true.
Even family stories.
Family stories. Historical stories.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what the poem about Salome is about, I think.
Well, let's take a short break, And then we'll come back. I'm so glad we were able to hear the origami poem, because I think if anyone has an origami poem, it's meant to be out in the world.
Yes. Bring them on. Bring us your origami poems.
Indeed. Today on Living Writers, Raymond McDaniel, his book, The Cataracts, the origami poem, Tricky. Page 114. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Raymond McDaniel is here. The Cataracts, out now with Coffee House Press. And I know I got our copy at Literati Bookstore. So I think there might even
be
some
Literati.
Literati, friend of the show.
They've been amazing.
They might even have some signed copies still there.
If they don't have any signed copies left, I'm in the store all the time.
So Raymond McDaniel,
they're easy to get.
Shall sign some when he next ventures.
Yes, you could probably unload those for like a quarter on eBay too. So you could make some money. The opportunity is there.
So again, thanks for choosing the songs.
Thank you for letting me choose the songs.
It's so evocative.
It's a dream life.
It is a dream life. So which song which poem does this song connect to?
So that was Fantastic Voyage by Lakeside. And Fantastic Voyage, you might recall, is there's a movie of Fantastic Voyage, which is about people being shrunk to a very small size and injected into a human body and having a, dare I say it, fantastic voyage. and that fascinated me when I was a kid because of my own vision, right? My nearsightedness. I can see things up close really well. And so looking very closely at things that normally you can't see very well was kind of an escapism for me, right? It kind of created this physical world that I could just disappear into.
Even your handwriting. Yeah.
Even my handwriting.
You would bring it down into this so it was almost your own thing. It wasn't necessarily meant to communicate to teachers or...
Well, I mean, the occasion was communicating to teachers,
right.
But much to their complaint. Yeah. I was making it, you know, legible for me.
An art.
I don't know if I'd go
sort.
That far. A craft.
A craft.
So this is the interchangeable world of the Micronauts. What half-blind is like. Like two microscopes in my head, each with differently stuck objectives. They enable the small and the very small, and reduce everything else to blur and shade. Yet you can train even this. Train it to spot the shape of shark's teeth, of which there are many samples and many shapes, but not as many as flecks of sand, pieces of shell. I have hundreds plucked from the shore. But in the same beach, I buried a toy and never found it again. A tiny toy. Articulate, a translucent man. A smallness to whom the world was an unbounded wonder. Blemished and damaged, I would hold him up and say, he is broken. And anyone who could see would say, he looks fine to me. But they can see well, not finely. Look at his face, etched and serrated by that gargantuan saw. The cracked shell of his translucent skin, buried in rubble now, and all those teeth, all that remained of terrible, a and invisible jaws.
So that tiny figure.
A micronaut.
Why did you, that's a lovely poem. I actually love that one. And with the shark teeth and the idea that you could be able to somehow with your special vision, you were able even to find shark teeth on the beach. But then taking the chance to bury the micronaut, and yeah. believing that you would find him again, right? In the burying.
Or was it assuming that I could.
An experiment or...
No, it's just, you know, the shark's teeth were, of course, on the shore. And, you know, I had whatever childlike height from above. And so I shouldn't have been able to see them. And technically, I didn't see them. I just trained myself to recognize the shapes that they approximated. Right? So anything that fell into that shape, right, I just learned by practice. So technically, I was identifying them, but I wasn't seeing them. But with the toy... Right. I was on my hands and knees. I'm playing in the sand. I can see it. Right. It was close to me. So I knew what was happening. And so I just assumed that burying it would be safe because, well, I can see. And so I have control. But in both instances, it's just the opposite of what I would have expected. Right. What I thought I could see and control, I couldn't. And what technically I couldn't see, I could.
And the vastness and the emptiness of the sand as well, in some ways, not being able to find him again.
Yeah, even if I could see its features better than other people could, right? I actually can see the grains of sand on the beach, but that kind of clarity, that kind of focus didn't help.
So in the writing of the cataracts, or when you were writing this group of poems over the last 6 years. Were these moments surprising to you when you remembered the micronaut? Or is that, because that isn't one of those memories that are ever present, right?
No, almost everything in here is stuff that I think about recurrently. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think a day goes by where I don't think about those toys or that beach. Almost all of the things in here are things that I think about more or less constantly. Yeah, well, you know, everybody has their corpus, right? Everyone has their set of references, right? You know, it's just your toolkit. It's the stuff that your brain is full of. And then there are the new things or the things that you pay attention to via circumstance. And then there's the default settings. And everything in here is just these are Ray's default settings. Yeah, so if you could actually shake the brain and have actual objects come flying out, this is what you'd probably find.
And so do you think the micronaut stays with you because it's something that when you were a boy, you were sure of that you could see, and you also realized that others couldn't, that brokenness?
Well, I mean, in that instance, you know, so I was a really fastidious owner of these toys because if they were damaged in any way, I could see the damage. The damage was very conspicuous to me, and it just wouldn't be conspicuous to anyone else. But I think I identified with them so strongly because they were physically the size in the actual world of my vision of that world. Right, so they were like this three-dimensional extrusion of what my vision was like. Like my, you know, so if I was the size physically of my ability to see this world, this is the size I would be. So they were like little avatars to me. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, this is their sense of scale was my sense of scale.
Okay, so let's change gears here and talk a little bit about being a citizen in the world, because earlier you connected the time of the book, the cataracts, ostensibly 1981 for much of the narrative, the Reagan years to our time now. And I know from knowing you a bit about the value that you place on being active now as a citizen in the world, maybe poet citizen, citizen poet.
Yeah, well, you know, can't not, right? Yeah, it's just no one really has the option to watch now. And I don't know necessarily what the right thing to do is, right? But I know that, like, so one of the things that was interesting about the early 80s to me is that if you remember the 70s and the 80s, I think it's fair to say that the 70s felt exhausting, right? They were an exhaustion of kind of self-indulgence. And it pivoted in the 80s to a kind of self-regard, as if everyone was very tired of seeing the faults or the failures or the limits of what was apparent to them in the 70s. And what they chose was delusion, right? And in some ways, yeah, and in some ways we've never recovered from it, right? It was such a profound rightward shift in so many ways. And it's just been dragged further and further right in so many ways ever since, largely because of that key dynamic, I think, which is just a refusal to admit failure or hardship or incompleteness or suffering. So the grandiosity, right, of the kind of moral claims of a ever resurgent right, which has just been more and more resurgent over the course of my life. Yeah, that I think in some ways that can only be remedied by a willingness to admit difficulty.
And what your poem, This Is Going to Hurt, I wonder, could you read the last stanza maybe? Because I know we're close to time here, or the last stanza or so, or wherever you feel.
Sure, yeah. So the last six lines. No one will miss us. No one would. Still, do what you can. You can imagine an empty room, but cannot live in one. You can imagine an empty world, but cannot live in one. But while it persists, you can only persist with it. Do what you can to solve a problem that cannot be solved, until there is no one left to miss what never should have been.
Raymond McDaniel, today on Living Writers. The Cataracts, the book out now with Coffee House Press. Thanks very much, Ray.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Steph. Thanks, T.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Until next time.